It was white people, it was European immigrants that experienced this. And about 100 years ago, the same people that produced statistics recognized that they should see violence as symptomatic of a capitalist society that is grinding people and that is committing acts of violence in the economy itself. And how to fix that was not through policing. How to fix that was to invest in those community with pro-social interventions, to give people the economic security, the collective bargaining rights, the right to be seen and to simply be, as I, again, to quote my colleague Kelly Lytle Hernandez. So we are still living with Hoffman. Hoffman's legacy in defining crime statistics among black and brown people as evidence of their dangerousness and then driving policing as the response to that is still the legacy we live with. It is the infrastructure that we, many of us, are trying to dismantle.
We want to thank you so much for being with us. And I just want to end again. You've got the three guilty verdicts on Chauvin. And then in Columbus, Ohio, right at the time the verdicts were being read, many inside watching those verdicts, a police officer fatally shot four times a black teenage girl, 16-year-old Micaiah Bryant. That does it for our show. Khalil Gibran Muhammad, thanks so much for being with us. Professor of History, Race, and Public Policy at Harvard Kennedy School, author of The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe. Wear a mask.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
If you're a lover of all kinds of music and how it makes you feel, please tune into Passing Sound every fourth Sunday at 8 p.m. on KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM or KBOO.FM, where we analyze elements in music to create an eclectic playlist for the listener to enjoy.
KBOO Community Radio is supported by our members and by the Columbia SLU Watershed Council's SLU DIY House Party, an excuse to let loose. An online benefit on Friday, April 23rd, with live music from Wren, the Matisse's Latin Ensemble, and DJ Mr. Mom. Tickets and more information can be found at columbiaslu.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this spring membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, shortly after the verdict in the Derek Chauvin case was read, police shot and killed a 16-year-old girl in Columbus, Ohio. The Department of Justice announced that it will begin investigating the Minneapolis Police Department, and a new study on air quality reveals that one in four people live in a county with unhealthy levels of air pollution. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 21st, 2021. KBOO is currently in our membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Althea Billings. The jury in the murder case of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin has found him guilty on all counts. He faces up to 40 years in prison. Yesterday, thousands of people gathered outside the courthouse in Minneapolis to await the verdict. For more, we go to Faven Gerezguher with the Racial Reckoning Project.
On Tuesday, a jury found former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin guilty on three counts in the murder of George Floyd. He faces up to 40 years in prison. Thousands gathered outside the courthouse and at George Floyd Square, anxiously waiting for the verdict.
Guilty! Yeah!
The news came as a relief to many. Floyd's brother Philonis said his family can finally breathe again.
I feel relieved today that I finally have the opportunity for hopefully getting some sleep. A lot of days that I prayed and I hoped and I was speaking everything into existence, I said I have faith that he will be convicted.
Dr. Uhuru Williams is a civil rights scholar at the University of St. Thomas. He said the verdict is just one win in an ongoing battle.
We're still facing the specter of what happened to Dante Wright. We're still talking about a national reckoning with race and policing in this country. And we still have to deal with the foundational issues that contributed to this case. It's one thing to focus on and talk about what happened to George Floyd. It's another thing to look at the unjust laws that contributed to this circumstance.
Community activists continue to call for investments in public safety as well as the passage of 8 police reform bills at the state legislature. 3 other police officers are charged with the murder of George Floyd. They are scheduled to go on trial on August 23rd. For the Racial Reckoning Project, I'm Fevan Garazgihar.
Shortly after the verdicts in the Derek Chauvin trial were delivered, police in Columbus, Ohio shot and killed a black 16-year-old girl named Makia Bryant. Bryant herself had called 911 and grabbed a knife in self-defense after an argument with someone at her foster home. Police body cam footage released just hours after the murder shows Bryant and another teenager fighting outside the house as the police arrive. Bryant raises her arm holding a knife and a police officer shoots her 4 times. After the body cam footage was released, grassroots organizer and abolitionist Bree Newsom Bass tweeted, quote, "Black people holding any object in their hand or reaching for any object, even if it's only the police officer's imagination, is grounds for deadly force. White men gouging out a cop's eyes, attacking cops with bear spray, throwing a fire extinguisher at a cop, no need to shoot." Newsom's tweets highlight the disproportionate amount of black folks that are shot by police versus the numerous white mass shooters, including Kyle Rittenhouse, who killed 2 in Kenosha, and Robert Aaron Long, who just last month murdered 8 people in Georgia. Yesterday's guilty verdict in the Chauvin trial has intensified calls for federal police reform. With more on the story, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We are all a part of George Floyd's legacy, and our job now is to honor it and to honor him.
Vice President Kamala Harris and President Joe Biden addressed the nation Tuesday night, not long after the guilty verdict was read in the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. The death of Floyd, a black man, sparked racial justice protests around the world. Biden praised the verdict and said this can be a time of significant change.
There can never be any safe harbor for hate in America.
Missouri Congresswoman Cori Bush was among members of the Congressional Black Caucus watching the verdict live.
Black folks in this country, all we're doing is saying our lives matter. We're not asking for more than somebody else is asking for.
California Congresswoman Karen Bass called for bipartisan compromise on the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, which passed the House.
Today just marks the beginning of a new phase of a long struggle to bring justice in America.
The act would create national standards for police behavior and add restrictions on use of deadly force. The Senate Judiciary Committee held a hearing Tuesday on whether new election reform measures introduced in Republican-led state houses are attempts to disenfranchise black voters. During his testimony, freshman Congressman Burgess Owens of Utah condemned characterizations of Georgia's election law as a Jim Crow measure.
It's disgusting and offensive to compare the actual voter suppression and violence of that era that we grew up in with a state law that only asked that people show their ID.
Democrats countered that federal election laws are needed to prevent voter suppression. Meanwhile, the Green New Deal is back.
It is an intergenerational compact to save the planet, spearheaded by our young people who are going to face the most dire impacts of the climate crisis if we do nothing to stop it.
Massachusetts Senator Edward Markey joined other Democrats to reintroduce the Green New Deal. The 2019 climate plan seeks to end greenhouse gas emissions within a decade. Republicans argue it's heavy-handed government regulation. Arizona Governor Doug Ducey is deploying the state's National Guard to the border with Mexico and issuing an emergency declaration in response to the surge of migrants. The Biden administration's been criticized for how it's addressed the crisis, which saw more than 172,000 migrants encountered in March alone. Flags have been ordered at half-staff to honor Walter Mondale, who passed away Monday.
Vice President Mondale will be remembered as a lion of progressive politics, an ardent defender of civil rights.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer paid tribute to the 93-year-old who served as President Jimmy Carter's right-hand man before waging an unsuccessful presidential bid in 1984. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
Yesterday's verdict in the Derek Chauvin trial was an extremely unusual occurrence in the world of policing. Since 2005, only 7 police officers have been convicted of murder, even though police have killed over 15,000 people in that time. Groups in Portland, though aware of the significance of the guilty verdict, released statements yesterday focusing on the systemic change that needs to happen in our community as well as across the country. The Black Millennial Movement released a statement acknowledging this painful process for communities of color, saying, quote, "We are not bitter, we are angry. While we are thankful and elated that a guilty verdict was passed down, it is still a failure of the system, a system that chooses capitalism over human life. This system is failing all but the few." They continued, quote, "Regardless of today's verdict, we need a drastic shift towards nationwide accountability measures. We need transformative change." Don't Shoot Portland also released a statement saying, quote, "Justice was not served today. Justice would be George Floyd still breathing. We do not celebrate the bare minimum of accountability, but we are grateful for what could be the start to true police abolition." Grassroots community groups in Minneapolis say that Derek Chauvin's verdict is an opportunity for all of Minnesota to take an important step in addressing longstanding racial inequities. Mike Moen has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Ground-level community groups in Minneapolis say the Derek Chauvin verdict is still being processed on an emotional level, but they see it as an opportunity for all of Minnesota to take another step in addressing longstanding inequities. Some racial justice advocates say they have mixed feelings about Chauvin being convicted on all counts for the murder of George Floyd. Vanessa Fuentes with the Headwaters Foundation for Justice says in a sense there's no justice because Floyd isn't alive. But she still sees a window for the state, not just the Twin Cities, to speak up and take action.
Whether you're on the front lines, on the streets, moving justice forward, or whether you're on the back end of the movement and resourcing from a different place, whatever your skill sets are, whatever your talents are, we all have a role to play.
The foundation, which is located in South Minneapolis near where Floyd was killed, says many of the groups it works with aren't at a point yet to fully embrace the outcome or declare victory. At the state capitol, police accountability groups are applying more pressure on lawmakers to adopt a host of reform measures. As for community-level efforts, Fuentes says it's important to acknowledge that activists and residents will have to navigate a range of emotions in the coming months. That's in part because three other former officers in Floyd's case will see their trial begin later this year.
There's still a lot of trauma in the community, and there's still a lot to kind of work through.
She also notes the group seeking justice for the death of Dante Wright, who was fatally shot by a Brooklyn Center police officer this month. That former officer faces manslaughter charges. And although authorities have described the incident as an accident, there's controversy about whether those charges are sufficient. Mike Moen, Public News Service.
One day after Derek Chauvin's murder conviction was handed down, the U.S. Department of Justice launches an investigation into possible patterns of discrimination and excessive force within the Minneapolis Police Department, including at protests. U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland announced the investigation today. He said, quote, "Yesterday's verdict in the state criminal trial does not address potentially systemic policing issues in Minneapolis." He also said that the investigation is separate from the previously announced federal criminal inquiry into George Floyd's death. The Minneapolis Police Department is also being investigated by the Minnesota Department of Human Rights, which is focusing on the department's policies and practices over the last decade. The Department of Justice investigation will focus on something called pattern or practice, looking into whether there is a pattern or practice of unconstitutional or unlawful policing within the department. It will examine use of force, including force used at protests, and will assess the department's current systems of accountability. President Obama's Justice Department investigated more than 24 police departments for illegal patterns or practices. The Trump administration investigated one. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on Grow Portland, a nonprofit dedicated to connecting school kids with their natural world. After that, it's news from the Boo, your look at the news inside KBOO. At 6, it's Rural Roots Rising. At 6:30, it's Free Culture Radio. Then at 7, tune in for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 45 degrees. Tomorrow we can expect partly cloudy skies with a high of 66. On this day in 2003, musician and civil rights activist Nina Simone died at the age of 70. Born in 1933, Simone is regarded as one of the most influential recording artists of the 20th century. In her autobiography, she wrote that her function as an artist was to make people feel on a deep level. She continues to be known as the High Priestess of Soul. The quote of the day is from Simone, who said of her career, quote, "As a political weapon, it has helped me for 30 years defend the rights of American Black folks and Third World people all over the world, to defend them with protest songs, to move the audience and to make them conscious of what has been done to my people around the world." The Oregon Health Authority reported 580 new cases of COVID-19 on Tuesday, bringing the total number of confirmed and presumptive cases in the state up to 176,172. Oregon health officials reported one new death, bringing the state's death toll to 2,461 people. There are currently 255 people hospitalized statewide, including 57 patients in intensive care. So far, more than 2.6 million doses of a COVID-19 vaccine have been administered across Oregon, and 25% of the population has been fully vaccinated. Governor Kate Brown announced on Tuesday that Washington County, along with 9 other counties, will move up to the higher-risk COVID-19 category on Friday. This means there will be 23 counties in the higher-risk level, 3 at moderate risk, and 10 at lower risk. These risk levels will remain in effect until May 6th. Over the past 2 weeks, new cases in Oregon have increased by about 55%. Despite the recent surge, indoor full-contact sports will resume in the state. The new regulations will allow Oregonians of all ages to engage in basketball, wrestling, cheerleading, and other indoor activities. Additional guidance is forthcoming from the OHA and will require sports organizations to follow health and safety rules to lessen the risk of COVID-19. Nationally, the U.S. has reported 31.7 million cases of the virus. At least 567,000 people have died. All adults in every state are now eligible for a COVID-19 vaccine. More than 3 million doses are being administered each day. So far, 40% of the population has received at least one dose of a COVID vaccine, with 26% of the population fully vaccinated. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 142.5 million people. More new coronavirus cases were reported around the world last week than in any 7-day period since the beginning of the pandemic. At least 3 million people have died. Margaret Harris, a spokesperson for the WHO, noted recently that it took 9 months for the world to reach 1 million pandemic deaths, then 4 months to pass 2 million, and just 3 months to reach 3 million. New legislation called Ida's Law was signed in Oklahoma on Tuesday. The law is meant to address unsolved cases of missing and murdered indigenous people in the area. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt signed legislation Tuesday known as Ida's Law to address unsolved cases of missing and murdered Native Americans. It's named after Ida Beard, a 29-year-old citizen of the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes who went missing in 2015. Relatives attended a signing ceremony in Oklahoma City. Ida's cousin, Lorenda Morgan, expressed gratitude. She spoke with KOCO 5 News.
A lot of Natives feel invisible, and that's how the family felt about Ida's case. And they felt that no one cared.
The bill directs the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation to coordinate with the U.S. Attorney's Office and Justice Department to obtain funding for a database. It also creates an office to work with tribal, state, and federal authorities on cases. According to state lawmakers, there are more than 220 missing American Indians in Oklahoma. Members of the Native community in the Minneapolis area were among those closely watching the trial of former police officer Derek Chauvin, who's been found guilty in the murder of George Floyd. Following Tuesday's verdict, there was celebration, relief, and discussion of moving forward on Twin Cities talk show Native Roots Radio. Minnesota's Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan from the White Earth Nation also expressed moving forward. In a statement on social media, she said, "It's a step towards justice and work's not done on public safety." Native community members have supported the Black Lives Matter movement since Floyd's death last May. Within days of Montana's first confirmed COVID-19 case, the Blackfeet Nation declared a state of emergency. 1 year later, Blackfeet Nation is one area leading the country in high vaccination rates. In part one of this two-part story, Yellowstone Public Radio's Caitlin Nicholas reports on the techniques the tribe's using to get the vaccine to anyone who wants it.
Just watch the door when, oh yeah, that first step comes out, so.
Okay. A high wind keeps pushing over a heavy plywood sign reading, "Vaccine shots here," in a parking lot in St. Mary, in the northwest corner of Montana. Beside the sign is the black RV the Blackfeet Tribal Health Department operates as their mobile clinic, taking COVID-19 vaccines from one remote town to the next. Inside is a group of first and second year nursing students from Blackfeet Community College, their instructor, and Brittany Racine, a registered nurse at the Tribal Health Improvement Program. Racine says walk-in vaccine appointments were open to everyone a month ago, at the same time they launched the mobile RV clinic.
Because a lot of the barriers to health, like barriers to getting the vaccine and stuff, is no transportation or finances.
This strategy is just one factor contributing to Blackfeet's high vaccination rate. Once the vaccine was available to any adult in mid-March, regardless of residency or tribal status, nurses say people traveled to their clinics from as far away as California, Idaho, and Seattle to get a shot. But others just happened to be in the area. Daniel Hines was replacing logs on older buildings in Glacier National Park.
The maintenance guy told me they happened to be in the parking lot and they were giving away shots. And I knew I could get an appointment, but it's right here, right now, so I said, what the heck?
Community protection started early in the pandemic when Blackfeet Nation took proactive measures to minimize exposure to the coronavirus. A study published by the CDC in early April found stay-at-home orders and mask mandates put in place by the Blackfeet Tribal Business Council last fall resulted in a 33-fold reduction of COVID-19 cases on the reservation. Nurse Racine says unvaccinated locals are now just those who aren't ready to get it.
I think we've pretty much covered everyone that wants to get it. And I think the last 5%, they're going to start slowly trickling in. And we received the Pfizer vaccine, so we'll be targeting our 16 and 17-year-olds now.
As of April 15th, Blackfeet COVID-19 Incident Command reported 7,900 people have been vaccinated, including over 95% of adult members of Blackfeet Nation. In Montana, for National Native News, I'm Caitlin Nicholas.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The Biden administration has taken the first steps in the process to eliminate a rule that forced more than 900 reproductive health clinics nationwide to leave the family planning program. Those clinics lost millions in funding, but this action could help improve access to affordable birth control in low-income and rural communities. Nadia Ramlagan has more on the story with the Public News Service.
The Biden administration has taken the first steps in the regulatory process to eliminate the domestic gag rule, which forced over 900 reproductive health clinics nationwide to leave the Title X family planning program and lose major amounts of funding. Rachel Fay of the contraceptive access advocacy group Power to Decide says the move is essential to improving access to affordable birth control in low-income and rural communities.
So getting rid of that gag rule and increasing annual funding for Title X are two things that this administration is beginning to do and that Congress, in terms of the funding level, can build on that we think are critically important.
In Arkansas, state lawmakers are considering a bill that would allow pharmacists to prescribe contraceptives directly to customers. According to the National Alliance of State Pharmacy Associations, at least six states already allow pharmacists to prescribe birth control. Fay points out a significant number of Arkansas counties have only one health clinic or provider per 1,000 women offering reproductive planning options, making them so-called contraceptive deserts.
So, for example, that might mean that there is a health center in their county that offers the full range of methods, but the number of low-income women who depend on that clinic versus its capacity might not be in line.
Fay adds lack of access to birth control particularly affects Black, Brown, and Indigenous women. She thinks more work is needed to ensure women in disadvantaged communities have the tools they need for family planning.
a broad network of health centers that offer the full range of methods and policies that help augment that with good coverage of the full range of methods without copay, no matter how much money you make, no matter where you live.
Arkansas has the nation's highest teen pregnancy rate and one of the country's highest unintended pregnancy rates among women of all ages, according to the CDC. For Public News Service, I'm Nadia Ramlagan.
135 million Americans, that's more than one in four people, live in counties with unhealthy levels of air pollution. That's according to a report released today by the American Lung Association. The association's 22nd annual State of the Air report also found that people of color were three times as likely to live in the country's most polluted places. The study analyzes the two most widespread outdoor air pollutants, ozone and airborne particles. Cities with the worst year-round particle pollution include Fairbanks, Alaska, and numerous cities in California, including Los Angeles and Bakersfield. Catherine Pruitt is the National Senior Director for Policy at the American Lung Association. She says that, unfortunately, quote, California has always struggled at the top of all our lists. That's due to traffic, shipping, and mountain ranges that create bowls where air pollution becomes trapped. Wildfires are also a contributing factor. The report is a slight improvement from last year's report that showed 150 million people living with unhealthy air. In an effort to get conservative Christians more involved in the issue of climate change, a Christian college is now offering a class focusing on the effects of global warming. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on that story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Brian Webb wants more conservative Christians to get involved in climate action.
The church is really missing the ball on this. We are not actively engaging with what is one of the most complicated and important issues facing humanity today.
Webb is the sustainability director at Houghton College, a small Christian college in New York State. This spring, he's teaching an online class called God, Country, and Climate Change that helps Christians engage with global warming. To reach people who may be skeptical, the course starts with the common ground of faith.
This idea of God made the world and called it good. This idea, Jesus says, that the two most important things you can do is love God and love your neighbors. Well, how are we loving God if we are intentionally disregarding and trashing the world that he has made? And how are we loving our neighbors if we're not proactively working to care for the ways that they're being impacted by the climate crisis?
The course also includes climate science and features guest lecturers who are experts in their fields. Houghton College has made the class available to the public for free, and Webb says when it ends, the class recordings will be available online.
The topic is too important to not get it out there in front of people as widely as possible.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael won't be calling the police.
Yesterday, the policeman who killed George Floyd was convicted. Tomorrow is the funeral of Dante Wright, killed by police. Who will be killed this weekend, by police or a young white guy with semi-automatic weapons? Why do the police hire former military snipers like the one who killed Robert Delgado in Lentz Park on Friday? Seems more like law enforcement than enforcement, with ticky-tack laws that give police an excuse to pull over anyone, disproportionately people of color. Why couldn't Mayor Wheeler wait for the verdict in the Derek Chauvin trial before declaring a state of emergency, and why didn't he cancel it when the convictions came through? Does Wheeler control the police? Is it the other way around? Or is the question who controls the police and the mayor? And not just here in Portland. Pick a city, any city. When you, a friend or a relative, is having trouble, the last folks you want to call are the police. Yes, most of them are excellent, brave, compassionate people doing one of the hardest jobs, but it only takes one bullet, one knee to the back of your neck. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You are listening to a spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 21st, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael and Nat Moon. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Favin Gerezgihad, Antonia Gonzalez, Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, Mike Moen, Nadia Romlagon, and Mary Sherman. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our spring membership drive. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Earth Day is Thursday, April 22nd, and we're taking the opportunity to learn more about different avenues for environmental advocacy in our community. Today, I'm speaking with Michelle Welton, the Executive Director at Grow Portland, a nonprofit that works with schools to connect students to the natural world through their curriculum. Grow Portland was started in 2010. Welton describes how the founding director, David Weller, started out.
A lot of his initial work was around growing and building out community gardens, specifically for immigrant and refugee populations in the east part of the city. He worked really closely with the municipalities out there, as well as other nonprofits, building up, I think, 17 or so total garden spaces around East County in the first 7 to 8 years of the organization, as well as hosting seed saving and seed swap classes, some educational opportunities, did some urban farmers market type of things. And in 2015, schools started reaching out to Grow Portland. A lot of our schools, I think it's almost 80% of the public schools, have some sort of garden space that's been created over time. But what happens is that schools often, people move on, parents, you know, their children age out of school programming and teachers move on. So a lot of times gardens have been started by people but not carried through, and there's not active engagement in the gardens. So schools started reaching out to Grow Portland, and we started in 2015 with our first school garden programming with the intent that we build long-term relationships in the schools so that those school gardens and outdoor learning spaces remain vital and engaging for the entire school community, not just a single grade or an after-school program, but that all kids get to engage in the garden. So today, that is primarily our focus. We've handed off most of the management of the community garden work to the City of Portland and other focused nonprofits, and then Grow Portland primarily does the support of public school programming and gardens with both Portland Public Schools and David Douglas School District.
Each month, Grow Portland provides school curriculum that has a different theme that focuses on an aspect of agriculture, ecology, and the environment. The lessons are also designed to be in line with the next generation science standards. Welton explains.
So based on what a child is supposed to be learning about a water cycle during water month, they'll be learning that in our curriculum. And so it is not considered like an extra programming. It is integrated into programming at all schools. And it's kind of one of the unique things about Grow Portland's model is that we do integrate with the entire school. So over the course of the month, all students get a chance to go out to school gardens. Now during COVID, obviously that has looked different, and it has been mostly remote education where our educators design curriculum activities that kids can do at home and create video lessons and upload them
available to schools. And then we've offered virtual field trips. So our educators will be at their school garden, and then a classroom will sign up and log on and get to participate in garden class virtually. So it's looked a little different this past year. We've been considered essential providers by the school district. So we've continued to maintain and support the gardens with, you know, keeping weeds, taking care of beds, growing food for the school community. And now we're transitioning and kids are in hybrids. So they're coming out to the garden, starting to engage at a perfect time. Things are starting to grow. Pollinators are out. We're getting mason bees out into the garden. So our approach is really about hands-on learning, letting students engage with the natural world. You know, while the curriculum is pretty robust, we also have a very strong focus on that socio-emotional health and learning how we be kind to all living things, how to care for the climate and the world in that process, and letting students have choice while they're out in that space. So there may be a number of different activities lined up that kids can engage in during their classroom garden time, all based around a single theme. So April's theme is pollinators. So they're learning about, there's 100 classrooms that have butterfly cocoons in their classes right now that they'll be releasing butterflies probably in the next week or so out to gardens, mason bees, and learning about all of those things as flowers start to bloom and greens start sprouting up in the gardens.
Those outdoor lessons happen whenever kids are in school, including in the winter months.
So we take kids outdoors every month of school. So they're outside, but we, you know, like our December lessons are about like the interconnectedness of like mycelium or mushrooms. So learning about like the soil health. We have a worm lessons that kids are holding worms and looking for worms in the winter. We do grow wintering over plants. So learning about how we take care of plants in the winter, whether it be kale or broccoli or things that winter over. We do January is all bird month, so wintering over birds and what birds live here throughout the year, and they go on like a little scavenger hunt, you know, looking for them. This year we sent home bird seed packets to kids to, and then a kit to go look at which birds live in Oregon year round and things like that. So they're themed to what's happening in the world because it doesn't really stop just because food's not actively growing.
Getting kids outside to learn and engage with their environment is crucial for Grow Portland. Welton explains some of the ways their curriculum helps children's education and development.
I think there's a lot of power in understanding, one, just where your food comes from and feeling empowered to engage with your food at a really hyper-local level. And that piece is important, but it's also just one piece of what we do. Yes, we grow food. Yes, kids get to interact with their food and learn about food choices and how to grow food. But at the same time, just really connecting with the natural world and the climate and understanding their impact and their power to make change really early on. I think we take for granted living in such a beautiful place that access to the outdoors is so easy. But we work in Title I schools, and so in a lot of places, kids are living in apartments and don't have as easy access to outdoor green spaces. So getting them outside as a part of their school day is really vital to their emotional growth and their sense of connection to the world and connection to make change, grow food, grow things, understand the integration of us as humans with the rest of the environment, whether it be water, soil, plants, animals, all of those pieces. And I think just taking the opportunity to breathe and relax, you know, we try to keep kids focused, but yet at the same time, you know, that choice is really important. So letting them feel like they have some power and autonomy in that space where they may not feel that in a lot of other places in their world.
Welton says there's often more to their organization's work than what can be gleaned at first glance.
You know, I think there's a big assumption like that we like grow food and it's about healthy eating and healthy living. And I think, yes, those pieces are part of it. But again, we want youth to be the leaders and them to be empowered. Our educators want to come alongside students and school communities rather than come in and say, we know how to do this right. We know what it should look like. And to that end, every single one of our garden spaces look a little different. There might be different things growing, different priorities for the school community in those spaces. And so I think those are a couple of things. I also think access is a thing that's often misunderstood. we do have a lot of gardeners and a lot of people that love being outdoors in Oregon, but understanding that not everybody has that access. Grow Portland has been working really hard the last 2 years to fully integrate our program, and that includes with our special education classes, which means upgrading garden spaces so kids who have mobility issues can access those spaces a little bit easier if we need ADA height beds and adaptive tools. But just the way they can interact with the outdoor learning spaces and get outside the same, that's been a huge priority of ours. And I think that can often be misunderstood, and it's a lot of work. It's a funny space to be in because a lot of people see this programming as an extra, and we need to focus on math and reading first, but all of those things are integrated into their time learning outdoors. And it really does integrate into the whole part of their being and their education.
The pandemic presented challenges for the group to continue teaching without having students there in person. But Welton says support and ongoing commitment to their work came from the ground up.
I think that there's a big push, even through the pandemic, for there to be creative thinking about teaching outside and getting outside. And we've seen some great examples happening, especially in other countries, of, you know, countries really putting their money where their mouth is and making that doable. It's been a much bigger lift here, and in some ways hard when we know the difference it makes to get outside and get kids engaging and learning outside, but yet not seeing funding and priority going to that, especially during a pandemic when we know that being outdoors is a safer place to be and that the viral load is much lower when people are outside. Kudos to some amazing public school teachers who, the second they went into hybrid, were reaching out to us and saying, how do we get our kids out in the garden? How quickly can we be out there teaching? How often can we be out there? So really it's coming from the ground up, which, you know, a lot of ways we wish it came from the top, from a funding perspective and really giving it dedicated attention, but it's happening. Kids are getting outside and learning outside, which is pretty great.
The pandemic also made it more difficult to get the supplies that Grow Portland usually relies on, but the restrictions related to COVID also pushed them to try new things and bring new opportunities to their students.
It's been hard to get things sometimes because there's so many more people gardening that our access to, like, get things sometimes has been hard. We had to go buy regular potatoes. Normally we buy seed potatoes, which are kind of already started to start potatoes. But, like, we couldn't even get them because no nurseries could keep them stocked. So we had to go buy, like, regular potatoes and, like, cut them up and seed them ourselves to get potato plants started this year. But it's opened up some unique opportunities. We've been able to do some video lessons with some farmers and naturalists of color that, because we work with all classrooms in 10 schools, there was no way we can't have a guest speaker come to that many, you know, to a few hundred classrooms. But yet we can do some video creation with them and go out and visit their farms and visit their spaces. And there's been for us some cool adaptations that I think we'll carry on past the pandemic.
When it comes down to it, Welton says the work that Grow Portland does is all about sustainability, both for the climate, for food production and the natural world, but also for students' ability to access the outdoors and learn from them.
Again, I think it's just about that sustainability, like integrating sustainability into everything we do. You know, we think about it in our own personal lives, but when we think about how do we sustain programs that are vital for kids, how do we sustain spaces for them, whether it be at schools or parks or other outdoor opportunities near them to connect with the natural world, I think those are so important to our health and well-being. I know personally, I'm a lot happier of a person when I've spent time outdoors. And so Grow Portland's pretty committed to making sure that kids get that opportunity, and all kids, regardless of income, regardless of ability and learning style, language. Our commitment is to make those opportunities to learn in the natural world, to understand their food and where it comes from and all those pieces. It's committed to make it happen, not just on Earth Day. There's a great hashtag out there, the every day is Earth Day, and I think that's kind of the focus of what we do our work and why, is to keep moving all of this forward every day.
That was Michelle Welton, the executive director of Grow Portland, a nonprofit that works with schools to connect students to the natural world in their learning. More information available on their website, growportland.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO with news from your community radio station.
Well, good evening. You are listening to News from the Boo here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Jenny Yokoyama, your host for News from the Boo, and also I'm one of KBOO's interim station co-managers. Here on News from the Boo, we talk about all things KBOO. It's a show for our volunteers, our members, our listeners, anyone who's just a KBOO fan. So first thing we're going to talk about, speaking of KBOO fans, for those of you who are fans of our special programming, tomorrow we have a full day of special programming just for Earth Day. That's tomorrow, April 22nd, starting all the way at 5:30 a.m. We have a special Earth Day edition of Rise When the Rooster Crows, and we have music and public affairs and documentaries coming up tomorrow all the way through 6 p.m. The focus for tomorrow's Earth Day programming is around climate change, climate action. We'll be looking at how people are planting the seeds, defending the roots, and trying to help ensure that, well, that humans have a future on this Earth, one that is sustainable. So tune in for that.